Just want to remind you what we did last time, which was to talk about faith as an act of buddhi or intelligence, and then discuss the role of intelligence, especially in its function of establishing mindsets or paradigms. And then we talked about paradigms and paradigm shifts and paradigm conflicts as described by Thomas Kuhn, and show how when these paradigms take place within the tradition of empirical science, they have certain characteristics which also show that these kinds of things, these determinations of paradigms, happen on the platform, not on the mental platform, but on the platform of buddhi. And I also wanted to associate that this is all by way of giving a theory of knowledge, that a determination of intelligence or an act of faith is really a precondition for knowledge, and that knowledge always takes place within a frame of reference, a context which is built around ideas of what is interesting, what is important, what basic categorical schemes we deal with. These frames of reference are usually established not by an individual, but are socially established. It may be that an individual comes up with their first paradigm. If he can't convince other people to buy into it, he's a nut. As soon as he gets a certain number of people, then it becomes a movement. So you need the social, the sociologists have called this the social construction of reality. Now, one thing about this way of looking at things is you can get very worried about being relativistic about the whole thing. Well, they're just different socially constructed realities. The socially constructed reality I'm going to talk about is the one established by Krishna. In other words, from my point of view, there is a privileged paradigm, which is not just one paradigm among others, but is the paradigm given by Krishna, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, there are many other questions that could follow from this, like what if he gives more than one paradigm at different times in different places, and that can be dealt with. But I just wanted to point out something to you by way of starting. The paradigm shift, or the paradigm difference, this thing is called when paradigms collide or something. And I quoted this verse, "What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled, and the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sages." Well, now listen to the Prabhupada's explanation of this verse. And now, having heard about buddhi and faith and paradigms, maybe we'll understand this a little deeper. He says, this is how he begins his purport, "There are two classes of intelligent men. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification, and the other is introspective and awake to the cultivation of self-realization." So you see, when he says one is two classes of intelligent, one is intelligent, in other words, they are directing their attention and their endeavors and their activities toward this particular end. And here he wants to say the real distinction, day and night, is self-realization and sense gratification. These are the two, the ultimate paradigms in collision that I want to talk about. So another place illustrates the same sort of use of intelligence as in here. Here's a sentence when he's discussing intelligence. Persons infatuated by material consciousness are very intelligent in discovering things for material comforts, but they have no access to understanding the spirit soul and spiritual life. We'll come back to this passage tomorrow. Well, this is Canto 3, Chapter 26. This is in the purport to Text 31. Now, another thing to bring in the social dimension, there's also a discussion of Shraddha in goodness, passion, and ignorance in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Part of our paradigm that we get from Krishna, which we'll discuss, is this sattva, rajas, and gunas is a way of looking at the world. And so I'm anticipating a little bit. He says, everyone has a particular type of faith. I'm saying faith is a universal condition, I believe what was discussed here this morning about stage one. You've got faith. And I said, when I became a devotee, I realized that was an act of faith, but it would have been an equal act of faith not to have become a devotee. And by act of faith, I meant that there was that decision. I could not see any rational grounds for ultimately justifying it because all grounds were at stake in that depth of that decision. I mean, of course, rational considerations play into it. But as Kuhn talks about, there's a circularity involved. Anyway, he says, everyone has a particular type of faith, regardless of what he is. But his faith is considered good, passionate, or ignorant according to the nature he has acquired. Thus, according to his particular type of faith, one associates with certain persons. So that's when you build up your reality, because if one is inclined one way, then that's the kind of persons one is attracted to and associate with, and that your whole worldview becomes constructed and reinforced in group. Another thing that Prabhupada says in talking about devotees, when he talks about faith, he says that faith is created by association with devotees. Faith is created by association with devotees, which is why that's a very important, especially in the beginning. We say to people, associate with devotees. Do not associate with materialistic people. And then later, you know, when things are well established, then you can become a little more open in one's association, but still one has to be careful. So that's just to illustrate this kind of social component by which our paradigms are established and work together. So I would like to say that if we look at what is going on with this idea of Shraddha, faith as commitment, as determination, as will. That really, when we see what Prabhupada says here, we could define Shraddha as a commitment to a particular style of life. When we look at what a devotee needs to do, he has to have a kind of, when we say vyavasa atmika bhuti, it's a kind of single-minded or dedicated commitment to a very demanding course of action. That's what we have to undergo. So that requires, the other thing to realize is this kind of thinking, we're talking about paradigms, they're always, or theories, at least in the Vedic context, there's not a theory that isn't related to some form of action. The Purva Mimamsa is right when it says that all Vedic statements have to do with action. And in this way, what you see is, at least, out of the pragmatic tradition in America, there's an analysis of knowledge. To put it simply, true is that which works. And there's some similarity in Krishna consciousness, because any kind of paradigm that we're given is not just there for our amusement or to look at, but is rather a guide for activity, spiritual activity, and for realization. So the reason we have to have Shraddha is not just that I believe certain propositions are true, but rather I have to be committed to, in a single-minded way, to a demanding course of activities. And that's why certain things are needed for me to have that commitment, one of which, very important, which is allegiance to an exemplary devotee, the position of the spiritual master. Here's somebody that is a successful person or an ideal person in this course of activity, and by looking at that person, I can have the commitment that it can be done, and with this person's help, it's doable by me also. That's why you have to have that sort of thing there. So, what it seems to me that ISKCON is about is ultimately anybody who comes and at least joins this society. Is we have become committed to self-realization, what Prabhupada calls self-realization as the ultimate goal of life. And if we want to become initiated devotees, when we become initiated, what we are doing is saying, this is the main thing in my life, the development of Krishna consciousness, and everything else in my life, I am subordinating to this central activity. It's not that I can't have other activities, but all those other activities have to be in support of this central thing. This is what meant by being single-minded in Krishna consciousness. And I think at least the appeal to me with Krishna consciousness is somehow or other, from meeting devotees and so on, I became convinced that somehow or other, becoming a real saint was a doable thing. It was a vocational goal. I'd read about saints in the past, and I thought that was something that happened way back then, and nowadays that's not done anymore. But then when I met devotees and met Prabhupada, what they're saying is you can be, see God face to face. Not that God is some theory we read about in some book, but you can actually, Prabhupada said, see God as you are seeing me and I am seeing you. Prabhupada said you can have direct spiritual perception of Krishna in relation to him. And he just told us you can do it. In fact, he used the word easy occasionally, which has been misinterpreted. Why did you tell Americans anyway, easy? I think you pop it in the microwave oven and it comes out in a few days. But he said it was, when Prabhupada said Krishna consciousness is practical, what he meant by practical means it can be done. It's in the United States, people would say doable. We can do it. So what we are given then by Prabhupada and by Krishna is a certain way of looking at the world, a kind of categorical scheme, a map of the way things are, which if we take that categorical scheme, if we take those categories of understanding, if we take that worldview and we use it as a guide to the way we see and the way we act, it will take us on the course of self-realization. The world is a very big and complicated place. is more complicated than any of us can ever understand. Certainly, when Krishna gives us his categorical scheme of things, it's simplified. But that's okay. It's good for the purposes that we want to attain, and it will work for that purposes. That's our and if it works, it's true. That's oversimplifying thing, but how else do you find out if something is true or not? Like for example, just to give an example of a map, Krishna gives us a map right in the beginning of the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And the first time I read Krishna's description, I was dubious, because he says to Arjuna, I shall now declare to you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and noumenal. This being known, there's nothing more to know. And I thought, come on, you know, this little book, is he going to tell us everything? But he does. He does. But he gives a, it's a map. He says, first of all, there is earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. These are my eight separated material energies. Right? That's the first thing you need to know. Here's the material energy. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Okay, that's really primitive, right? We don't do that anymore. Now we have hydrogen, helium, and, you know, up the periodical table of energies, and it's so complicated and intricate. And here Krishna turns around, and in the 20th century, we're supposed to think, you know, earth, water, fire, air, ether. Well, first of all, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur puts it in a different kind of language. He said, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. So immediately we feel better. Because it's in terms of density. You know, it's the Sankhya system where earth has five ton mantras or sense qualities, and water four, and so on to ether. But from subtle, from gross to subtle. In other words, subtle means less perceptible to our senses. So that ether is space, which is not nothing. It has certain properties. Even modern science, Sataputta says, if you want to describe empty space in quantum mechanics, it takes pages of mathematics. So it's not just nothing. Anyway, that's Krishna's scheme. And then he goes on, and that basically, that's material science, earth, water, fire, air, ether. That is. Then you get this other stuff, which are subtler still, manas, buddhi, and ahankara. Basically what we would call mind. And of course we find out that mind is matter. And it's divided up into this intricate way of manas, buddhi, and ahankara. Mind, intelligence, and ego, or false ego, as we say. We've already discussed the difference between manas and buddhi. And then there's ahankara. That's my subtle material energies, he says. Now, you may wonder about this scheme. And then there's, you know, other schemes. This is part of another scheme of Sankhya, where they also list other things as elements, the three modes of material nature. Now, the more complete description, because this is just a little summary, really. It's given in the Bhagavatam 11th canto. Now listen to this. Uddhava says to Krishna, my dear Lord, how many different elements of creation have been enumerated by the great sages? I have heard you personally describe a total of 28. God, the jiva soul, the mahatattva, false ego, the five gross elements, the 10 senses, the mind, the five subtle objects of perceptions, and the three modes of nature. That's a more complete description of the thing. So this is part of a larger categorical scheme. But some authorities say there are 26 elements, while others cite 25, or else 7, 9, 6, 4, or 11, or even others say that there are 17, 16, or 13. What did each of these sages have in mind when he calculated the creative elements in such different ways? So a supreme eternal kindly. Explain this to me. Huh? 11th canto, chapter 22, I'm starting at text 3. Lord Krishna replied, because all material elements are present everywhere, it is reasonable that different learned brahmanas have analyzed them in different ways. All such philosophers spoke under the shelter of my mystic potency, and thus they could say anything without contradicting the truth. When philosophers argue, I don't choose to analyze this particular case in the same way that you have. It is simply my own insurmountable energies that are motivating their analytical disagreements. By interactions of my energies, different opinions arise, but for those who have fixed their intelligence on me and controlled their senses, differences of perception disappear, and consequently the very cause for argument is removed. Because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another. So there's a deeper reason. Because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another. Because the gross are contained within the subtle and they evolve outward according to the scheme. Philosophers may calculate the number of basic material elements in different ways according to their personal desire. And he goes on like that. And then he describes the different ones, different numbers. And he says, thus great philosophers, I'm ending with text 25, have analyzed the material elements in many different ways. All of their proposals are reasonable, since they are all presented with ample logic. Indeed, such philosophical brilliance is expected of the truly learned. Nasavrishi yatta matana dinam. No one can be considered a great thinker who doesn't have his own opinion different from everybody else's. But anyway, Krishna recognizes that you can divide up the pie in all kinds of different ways according to your desire. I'm not arguing about that. But what I'm saying is here we do have one scheme that is given to us by Krishna for our guidance on the path of self-realization. And when I'm talking about faith, it means having confidence to use this scheme as a framework for our activity. Anyway, Krishna continues, we saw the first, this is earth, air, fire, water, ether, mind, as my separated material energies. Besides these, there is another superior energy of mind which comprises the living entities who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature, the jivas. So on the one side you have matter, material energy, and the other side you have the jivas. And then he says, all created beings have their sources in these two natures. Everything you see in the world is created by a confluence, a flowing together of these material elements and the conscious jivas. According to this scheme, the jivas are irreducible. They're fundamental entities. You can't break them down. Now, material science wants to take as their paradigm is basically there's earth, water, fire, air, ether. Maybe mind, they'll worry about that later. They can't figure out what to do with it yet. But basically what we call material science or mechanistic science is a basic thing that there are just simply structures of matter. And that in the course of time, these structures of matter become more complicated. By structures of matter, they mean anything, any phenomenon in the world that can be expressed in terms of numbers. You can weigh it or measure it or somehow or other you express it in terms of numbers, then science can deal with it. And that's all that there is. There's a methodological assumption that we have a tool, and there's an assumption that actually our tool fits all reality. But in a way, they're making reality conform to the tool rather than, in other words, if we can't deal with it, hey, it doesn't exist. You know, so that's their assumption. There's earth, water, fire, air, ether, and that's all. And then somehow or other, they've got to explain the fact of consciousness. This is where it seems to me their paradigm starts to become inadequate. Now see, for dealing with earth, water, fire, air, and ether, great, you know, no problem. The problem isn't that the paradigm is useless. It's useful, certainly. Otherwise you wouldn't have, you know, Hondas and atomic bombs and jet fighters and acrylic paints and all those wonderful things. I enjoy the benefits of modern civilization sometimes. It's useful. But then there's this act of kind of hubris that wants to say, then that's all that there is. You know? And then you have to explain how somehow or other all you have is structures of matter. Over the course of time, these structures of matter get more and more complicated. How that happens is another thing. It just seems to be the nature of things. Somehow or other, there's an anti-entropic system, and things get more complicated. And then, somewhere along the line, they get sufficiently complicated, but then something else pops into existence, which is not just structures of matter.